Okay, so I'm going to do a short story here, but short story. The story of the Mikalo, of the blasphemer, which is really a fascinating story, a tragic story. I'm going to try to understand it and the response of the Torah to it. So this is the end of Emor, right? We'd finished really the Yom Tov stuff. So the end of Emor in Perek, Chaf, Gimel, Pasuk, Yud. So we get the story of the blasphemer, and just we'll pay attention closely because the story is not so long, but it's really, really quite strange how the Torah presents it. So the Torah says, "Vayitze ben Isha Yisraeli, v'hu ben Ish Mitzri v'telch b'nei Yisrael." So there was the son of a Jewish woman and a Mitzri man. He went out. The Torah doesn't tell you where he went out from, but he went out.
What
parak of Gimel pasuk Yud. Or Perek Chavdala, rather.
Oh, Chavdala, looking at
Sorry. Yeah. Perek Chavdala, sorry.
Yeah.
Perek Chavdala, at the top of the page, it still says Chav Gimel, because it, you know, says the transition. Yeah. Perek Chavdala, Yud.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so this person who has a Jewish mother, non-Jewish father, goes out amongst the Jewish people. Vayinatu b'machaneh ben Yisraeli v'isha Yisraeli. And this son of a Jewish woman fights with the son of a Jewish man, meaning a full Jew. Va'ikov ben ha'isha Yisraelit et Hashem, va'ikalel, va'yaviu otol Moshe, v'shem imosh lomit batiri l'matei dan. So this person curses, blasphemes in the name of God. He curses the person he's fighting with in the name of God. And they don't know what to do with him, so they bring him to Moshe. And we find out that this person is the son of a woman named Shlomit batiri. Va'yanichu v'mishmar l'frosh lahem al pi adonai. And they put him in jail to figure out what they're supposed to do. And so this is something we find a few other times in the Torah, really one other time, by the Mekoshesh, where they know that what he did is wrong. They don't know exactly what to do with him, so they put him in a holding cell while they're going to ask God. So far, the story, I mean, okay, it's a bit of an interesting story, but nothing too strange about it. But then, things get a bit weird. So God starts to respond. So Hashem tells Moshe, he gets the death penalty, so take him out of the camp, and those who heard him blaspheme, so they should put their hands on his head, and everyone should stone him. And tell the Jewish people as a rule, in general, that anyone who curses God will be responsible for his sin. Then okay, shame Adonai mot yumat, ragom yigamuv kol haidaka, ger kazrach menakvo, shame yumat. And anyone who curses God will be put to death, he'll be stoned, whether you're a ger, or whether you're an ezrach, whether you're a citizen, or you're a ger. So until now, okay, I understand the flow. The person sinned, they didn't know what to do with him, they put him in a holding cell, God responds that this is his punishment, and you should know this is the law for everybody. But then in Pasuk Yud Zayin we get V'ish Kiyakeh Kol Nefesh Adam Mot Yumat, and if anyone kills somebody else, he will be put to death. Umake Nefesh Beheima Yishalmena Nefesh Tachat Nefesh. And if you kill an animal, so then you have to pay for the animal. V'ish Ki Tein Mumba Miton, if you damage your friend, Kasher Asa Ken Yasa Lo. So what you did to him is done to you. Shever Tachat Shever Ayin Tachat Ayin Shein Tachat Shein Kasher Yitin Mumba Adam Ken Yid Natin Bo. Right, a broken limb for a broken limb, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, whatever he did will be done back to him. Which again, Chazal understand is monetary, but for our purposes it's not, it doesn't really matter whether it was monetary or if it was literal, so we'll just assume that it is monetary. Umake vehema yishalmena, and if someone hits an animal, you'll pay back. Umake adam yuman, and if you kill somebody, you get killed. Mishpat achad yelochem gager gezrach yeh ki ani adonai lechem. The same law will be true whether you're a citizen or whether you're a ger, because I am Hashem, your God. Vayidaber Moshe al b'nei Yisrael vayotzivu et mekalel mechutz l'machaneh vayigamu oto even uv'nei Yisrael tzu kasher tziva adonai et Moshe. And Moshe tells the Jewish people, and they take the blasphemer out of the camp, and they kill him, just like God had told Moshe. So you look at the story, and the story is really quite strange, because in the middle of God telling them what you're supposed to do, we have this 5-6 pasuk, digression, where the pasuk says, and by the way, here's a list of random laws about damages, that if you, you know, if you kill somebody, then you get killed. If you damage money, then you have to pay, if you cause monetary damage, you have to pay monetary damage. And this clearly is in the middle of the discussion, because then Moshe goes back and tells this to Jewish people, and then they go and they actually carry out the sentence against the blasphemer. So what I want to try to do is understand what's going on in this story, and then based on that, try to figure out how, what is the Torah trying to do with this sort of very odd response to the story. And I'm going to draw primarily on Rabbi Foreman's analysis and on Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky's analysis of this story. So if we go back to the story, so the story itself, you know, it starts off reasonably enough. You know, it's not a good story, but it happens the way many stories start, is that two people get into a fight. Specifically, one person who is of questionable lineage gets into a fight with someone who's a full Jew, which is not an unreasonable thing to happen. That often happens. You can imagine what they were fighting about. As we'll see, Chazal will fill in the blanks with some of the likely things that may have happened there. All that is, you know, sort of pedestrian enough. But then he curses him. Then he curses. Now, you could say, I read it before as he cursed the other person, but it doesn't actually sound that way. You look at the pasuk, "Vayikov ben Yishai Yisrael et Hashem." It sounds like he actually blasphemed against God, meaning he cursed God. So the first question I think we need to ask, or the first sort of red flag that we need to ask is, well, why? Right, if the pasuk means exactly what it says, that not that he cursed the other person in the name of God, but that he actually cursed God, right? He committed blasphemy. Why is that his reaction to this, to the fact that he's in a fight? I mean, I understand why someone would curse the other person, right? That's sort of expected, right? Okay, so he cursed the other person. He shouldn't have done it, but I sort of understand rationally. I get how that happened, but why would he curse God in the middle of a fight? I mean, what was the purpose of that? So to answer that question, we have to figure out what was he fighting about? I mean, what was this whole story about? So here's a bit of imagination, right? We need to think. We need to figure out, well, what exactly, right? Who is this person? What is he fighting about? What's he so angry about? What's going on?
Something that's going to cause him to curse God, and it's something that's going to prevent him from, I don't know, something to do with his lineage.
Right, so the only clue we seem to have in the story is the emphasis on lineage, right? Look at the story, it doesn't tell you what they're fighting about. We get one clue, right? One clue is the obsession on lineage. I mean, we don't know his name. We know who his we know his mother's name, we know his father's nationality, and we know the nationality of the person he's fighting with. So it does sound like the key to this story is something to do with lineage. Now, we get a bit more of a clue. If we look at, we'll look at the Midrash in a second and see where the Midrash gets this from. But if you look at number two, this chart, the other hint we have is that those words don't just indicate that the key to the story seems to be his lineage. They also seem to connect us to another story. And that is the story in Shmot Perek Bet. In Shmot Perek Bet, when Moshe Rabbeinu first goes out to meet the Jewish people, so you look at the bolded words, right? We get the following story. Moshe goes out, that Vayetze, and he sees an Ish Mitzri. And he lurks both ways, he doesn't see anybody, so he kills the Mitzri. And then you have two people fight. I should have bolded that one. Nitzim, you have two people fighting with that same word, Vayinatsu. Vayomer la rasha la matakereach, and he turns to him, why you were hitting your friend. Vayomer bisamchali ishtar vishofet aleinu, haleg lahargeni ata omer, kasher harakted a Mitzri. You're going to kill me like you killed the Mitzri. Vayira Moshe, vayomer achenu da davar. So the Midrash says, and so the Pasuk says, that right, he said, are you going to kill me like you killed the other, like you killed the Mitzri? Now, based on those comparisons, the Chazal try to start filling in some of the gaps, and they suggest that this Ben Ish Mitzri isn't just a random Ben Ish Mitzri, it's actually this Ben Ish Mitzri, this Ish Mitzri, and they look at the textual cues that, right, this guy is unidentified except for the fact that he's Ben Ish Mitzri. And you have all these same words coming up, Vayinatsu and the Vayetze. So if you look at number one, actually, you know, we'll go backwards here. Look at Dalet, right? I've broken up the Midrash into a few pieces. A lot of this is going to be Midrashic, but you'll see where Midrash is getting this from. Because we'll see, even if the Midrash isn't, you know, whether it's Pshat or not, we can argue about what Midrash is trying to accomplish, but the point that will emerge from the Midrashic analysis is important. So you look at the Midrash here, number one, the second half of it, Dalet. This is the story they tell. But who Ben Ish Mitzri? Rabbanan v'Rabbi Levi, Rabbanan Amri, afal pi shelo hayu mamzirin ba'oto sha'a. During that time, there weren't actual mamzirim. Hu haya mamzer? He was a mamzer. Why was he a mamzer? So Rabbi Levi Amar, mamzer barur haya. He was actually a mamzer. How do we know? Ketzad. No ksin hayu mitzrim v'shotrin hayu Yisrael. Nogesh haya munei asar shotrim v'shotrim munei al asar b'nei adam.
So there was, in Egypt, the system was that there was one officer per 10 Jewish officers, and each Jewish officer in charge of 10 Jews, so every Mitzri officer in charge of 100 Jews. Chazman, what happened? One time, Kadam Nogesh Gabe Shoter, and Amar Le Zilknosh Li Chavutecha. So once, one of the upper-level officers, the Mitzri officer, got the Jewish officer and said, get your group together. Kevan she'nichnas. While this was happening, right, he was going in, sachakalo ishto. The wife of that shoter started flirting with the Egyptian. Amar dehadein gavra. He, and someone pointed out that this is the wife of that officer. So yatsa. V'itminatmo lacharei asulam. So what did he do? He hid himself behind a ladder, and Kevin Sheatzaba Allah Nichnas Kilkelima. So when the officer went to do his job, right, the job that he'd been tasked with, getting together his crew, the Egyptian taskmaster went and raped or seduced or whatever this person's wife. Hafach Lacharav Vichamite Nafak Mingo Beta. But as he's leaving, the Jewish officer sees him. Kevan diada dechamte, once the Egyptian knew that he had been found out, nafak ligabe v'hamei mechalei kol ha'yoma, he started beating the Jewish officer. V'amar lei, lai tabat, mitkaven boi lemiktlei, right? So he's hitting him, he's screaming, he wants to kill him, v'oto sha'a, he tzitz Ruach HaKodesh b'Moshe, and at that moment, the Ruach HaKodesh entered Moshe, and that's where Perek Bet of Shmot picks up, v'ifen kovacho, he was told what happened in the house of Asadeh. Amar lo lo dayosh kilkel him ishto. He said, is it not enough that you raped his wife? Elishu mivakesh largo. You want to kill him too? Miyad vayar keinish. So he sees there's nobody around. Rabbi Yehuda ben Chemi, Rabbanan, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rashi ein miyamod v'ikanei l'shmo shal Hakadosh Baruch Hu. He saw that there was no one to stand up for the name of God. Vayar geish. So he kills the Egyptian. Rabbi Chemi Omer, Ra'a she'ein miyamod v'yaskir alav et Hashem v'yar geihu. He saw that there was no one, right? That there was no one to stop him. So he mentions the name of God and he kills him. Rabbanan Amrin, and the Rabbanan say, Re'esh ein tochelet atida la'amod mimenu. The Rabbanan say what he saw is that no good would ever come out of him, and he killed him. So Chazal placed this Ben Ish Mitzri in this story, that he's the product of an unfortunate rape story. Right, where the officer had raped his mother and tried to kill his father to cover it up, and was only saved last minute because of Moshe's, right, heroic involvement in the story. Now, whether Chazal literally means to connect those two stories and assume that it's historically they must be the same person or not, I don't know. You know, you never know with Midrash. But let's assume the Midrash is being literal and try to figure out what the Midrash is getting at psychologically. Right, so
If this is the guy's backstory, what is he thinking, right? What is his experience of life, right? Right, there were no mamzerim b'otosha, but he is the mamzer, right? He is the unfortunate person who's born out, right? Everybody knows he's the only person, right? Right, this person we know is like he's gonna have his struggle for his whole life is gonna be to fit in, right, in society, right? Like he is the one person everyone knows the disgraceful backstory to how he was born. And he's just going to try to fit in, right? And we get the hint in the story that, yeah, he wants to fit in, right? Because he wants to presumably be part of Shevet Dan. But he's not, right? His mother is from Dan. He's known as the Ben Ish Mitzri, right? That's what is clear in the pasuk, right? His backstory starts to tell us that he's had a very unfair life until this point, right? It's not his fault that he's in the situation, right? His mother was raped. Okay. Now, what is the fight about, right? We now, okay, we may, if this is right, so we get a little bit of psychological insight. He's a guy who really wants to fit in. Now, what's he fighting about? So Chazal have three possibilities. If you look at the beginning of the Midrash, so they pick up this word, vayitze, right? So vayitze usually means, in normal parlance, was you go from place X to place Y. You go out to somewhere. So we know where he went, but we don't know where he's coming from. So Chazal asked the question, okay, well, where is he coming from? And maybe where he's coming from will answer the question of where he's going, or why he's going to where he's going. So let's just focus on, we'll focus on all the answers, but we'll specifically focus on one of them in specifically. But, okay, the Midrash says as follows, and this is classic Midrashic terminology, methodology, rather. This is pointed out by right, Nachman Levine, he's a professor of Midrash in Michigan, I think, in like the Chabad University or something. But he's very good at reading Midrash. He notes, right, Midrashically, Vayetze, what the Midrash is always going to do is connect Vayetze to what came before it, right? If you don't know the answer, where did someone come from, the way you do is you look at what came before it. But what came before the word Vayetze? So, multiple things come before it, right? Meaning, how far back do you go? Do you go to the previous word, the previous pasuk, the previous parsha, the previous perek? Like, how far back are you going to go? And that's actually what the Midrash does. So, Rabbi Levi Amar, Yatza Me'olamo. Kimandi Amar, Vayetze Ish, Havinayim. Vayetze Me'olamo. He left the world, meaning he gave up on his Olam Haba, presumably. Now, where do they get the notion that he's giving up on his Olam Haba, right? So, it's not an answer really where he's coming from. It's the upshot of the story is he's going to lose his Olam Haba, but they get that from the previous word, right? They're playing off on the previous word, Chak Olam, right? Vayetze Me'olam. He left the notion of Olam. Okay. Rebrachi Omer, Miparsha Mishel Ma'alan Yatza. He left the Parsha before. Now, what's the Parsha before? So the Parsha before is the laws of the Lechem Apanim and the Menorah. Right, the two parashiot before is the menorah, and the immediate parasha before is the shulchan. Right, the lakachta shelet v'afito ta shnei mesrei chalot. So Midrash says he's left that, meaning dark. He made fun of it. He said, "Darko shel melech liyot ochel pat chama, shema tzonenet, kihidas inyan taman lechem apanim minechal pachon mitisha v'lidra yud alef kitzin efe b'erev shabbat v'nechal b'shabbat l'tisha achal liyot yom tov b'erev shabbat nechal asara shnei yamim tovim shalashan nechal yud alef yidah bin tachuma." He made fun of the lechem apanim, you ate no earlier than 9 days after it was baked, because you baked it on Friday, you put it on the shulchan, you ate it the next Shabbat, so at least around the ninth day, and it was fresh, right? So he made fun of it. He said, how could it be that it is fresh? And he, these hiccups are really annoying. He said he made fun of the Lechem HaPanim. Now that gives us a little bit of an answer of, okay, why did he blaspheme, right? Because he's also seemingly a heretic, right? He's challenging mitzvot and challenging the possibility of miracles and things like that, but it still doesn't really answer the question, but it starts to build a picture. And the And the last one, and this is the one that I think is most compelling in the text itself, is Rabbi Chiya. Tani Rabbi Chiya, mi parshat Yochsin yatsa. He left a discussion, a court case, about lineage. Yatsa shabali ta'alo b'machanei dan. And this is based on our on the psukim itself. He wanted, right, the psukim draw attention to the fact that his mother is from Dan. Now, the third day in the Midrash says, well, likely, what was he challenging? He wanted to be part of Dan, and the other person didn't. But the only evidence we get in the story is that he's fighting with a full Jew. That, right, why does the Torah bother telling us he's from Dan? Well, the Midrash fills it in. Maybe he wanted to be part of Dan, but he wasn't. He was considered a Ben Ish Mitzri. So Amrulo, Malach Alita Alcha B'machani Dan, why are you bothering setting up shop in Dan? You're not Jewish, or you're not part of Dan. Amrulo, I don't even know Dan. He says, I'm from a daughter of Dan. Amrulo, it's very nice, but Siv, Ishal Diglo Beoto Lefeit Avotam, you go by your father's house, V'lo Lefeit Imotam, not your mother's house. So Nichnas Beitino Shal Moshe, V'yitzei Mechuyav Imo, Amad V'gada. So he went and had a court case, you know, and he lost. So he left, and he fought, and he blasphemed. Now here, right, you take the two, this third answer, and then the second half of the Midrash, and you start to get a picture that's actually pretty compelling in pshat, which is this person is clearly an outlier, is clearly, right, not really accepted in society. He wants to set up shop, he wants to be part of Dan, and the guy rejects him. Now that's a very painful situation. But what, right? So why would he blaspheme at that moment, right? Why would that lead him to curse God and not just the person that he is talking to, right? That he lost the court case to.
Well, he's upset about the law.
Yeah, right. Because his argument is not really with this guy from Dan. It's with God who set up the law. You know, it's an unfortunate situation. Like, imagine his situation. He blames God doubly. First of all, why did you have to allow my mother to be raped by an Egyptian such that I'm the only mamzer around in Klal Yisrael? Why do you have to set up the law such that I have no recourse? Like, life is not fair. His real taina isn't with the other Jew. His taina is with God, who caused him to be born into this situation, set the laws that just made his situation even worse. Right? That seems to be the shot reason why he blasphemes. It's like he is really upset that there's a law that excludes him, that he can't fit in. And it's not like he's in the midbar. Where is he going? Right? Like, there's no place. It means he's mechutz l'machane. Now, there can be more to it. Ray Tversky notes what the second line in the Midrash seems to mean, and I think this fills out the story a bit, is why would he, of all things, make fun of the Shulchan? Now, even if you don't think he actually made fun of the Shulchan, the Torah clearly does put the story of the Ish HaYisraeli right after the story of the Menorah and the Shulchan, but why would that be? So Ray Tversky says, well, think about it. This guy, what does he really not want to believe in? Right? What is the thing, what is really that which makes his life so miserable is the belief in the uniqueness of the Jewish people. And he's not part of it. Right? The more you emphasize the uniqueness of the Jewish people, the more he feels excluded. The menorah and the shulchan, of all the parts of the Mishkan, the Mishkan in general is meant to emphasize the special relationship between God and the Jewish people that he at some level seems to be excluded from, but specifically the Shulchan with its 12 loaves of bread, which seems to symbolize the Jewish people, right? And the menorah, which is opposite the Shulchan, which is supposed to light up that situation, right? He notes in the Rashban that the Shulchan is lit up by the menorah. The menorah and Shulchan seem to be a unit. Right, seem to be the symbolic place. It's the meal. It's where God and the Jewish people sort of eat together. Right, we have this symbolic 12 loaves of bread representing the Shvatim, as Ibn Ezra notes. He's not going to like that. Like any, right? If you're telling him you're not really part of the Jewish people, you don't get to inherit. So he's going to oppose celebrating Jewish uniqueness if he's not part of it. Or if he feels excluded, then he's just going to fight against it. And that does seem to be part of the story, is that he really, that this person is, right, is excluded from that. But now the question is, okay, so let's say that's what's happening. This guy has been unfairly, you know, it's unfair. He's a mamzer, he doesn't get inheritance, he's fighting, he's upset. If you want to know how, you know, how unfair it is, if you look at number three, this is the end of the Midrash. This has become a very famous Midrash, but the Midrash is something shocking on this line. This is Vayitzei ben Isha Yisraeli. It quotes a pasuk in Kohelet. The pasuk says, "V'shafti ani v'ared kol ashukim." I have seen all the oppressed. So the Midrash says, "Daniel Chayata, Daniel the tailor, patar kari bim mamzerim." He said the pasuk goes like this. It's about mamzerim. V'nei dim'ad ha'ashukim, the blood, the tears of the oppressed. Who are these? Avotam shel elu ovei averot. These people, this person's parents made sinned. V'ilein iluvaya ma'echpat lahun. These poor children, what did they do? Kachavishel ze bal erva, ze machatare. What did he do? Ma'echpat lo ve'en lehem menachem. And there's no one to comfort them. Right? Elam yadoshkeim koach. God says, I will save them from their oppressors. Who oppresses them? Miyan Sanhedre Gedolo Shel Yisrael. The oppressors, in the end of the day, is the Sanhedrin. Shabal Lemi Kokla Shel Torah, because they have to enforce the Torah. Umarachtan, so they have to reject them. They have to distance them. Alshum lo yavov mamzer bekal Hashem. Ve'en la menachem. There's no one who's going to comfort them. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Alay l'nachaman. So God says, I will comfort you. Lefi shebol mazeh yesh b'en psolet. Avol ozit lavo. Amar zachar nichamatei. Elu kursein, etc., etc. In this world, you're right, there is no comfort, but don't worry, eventually I'll make things better. Now, the Midrash has been used in many ways to point out the right, that Chazal sometimes reflected on the seeming immorality of Torah, and they were aware of this, and that they grappled with those problems. Whatever you want to do with that Midrash, the Midrash points out a truth, which is, the way the Torah system is set up is really unfair for the mamzer, and the courts have no choice but to, right, to impose God's laws, which leave this guy out in the cold. So you understand, when you build all of that up, you understand why he would curse God, or why in the Midrashic terminology he would make fun of the Shulchan, he would make fun of miracles, he would make fun of Jewish uniqueness, because it's unfair. The Torah is what has, right, God's own laws have what is what has created the unfortunate situation he seems to be stuck in for life. Right, God's only comfort is, I can help you in the next world. The right. Tversky notes that even the timing of this seems to make this right uncomfortable. Right, this is according to the chronology, this is around Nisan time in the second year in the Midbar. This is just that the Mishkan is being built. It's like the climactic moment where the Jews are celebrating that they build this relationship with God. It's not just like a random day that he's being excluded. It's when everybody else is celebrating that God has descended and God's presence is in the Mishkan, and that's when he's told, you're out of this picture, you're out of the story. But you can just imagine how angry he is and why he just turns to God and says, I give up. It's abdication. It's, I hate you, right? I don't want... Why did you make the laws in such a way? Why did I have to be born? And that's how it is in Eov, right? Cursing God is really a function of, right? Why did I have to be born? I bemoan the morning that my mother gave birth. If only the placenta had been turned backwards, right? Cursing God is partially cursing your own existence. Like, I just, right? Why am I here? So, right, the Midrash seems to pick up on this tension that, right, again, whether the Midrash is claiming he's actually the child of this person, it's clear that what's going on is he has this tension that is a function of the laws of Yuchsin, the laws of lineage, that he is excluded from. That seems to emerge clearly from the Pesukim, possibly the most shot-oriented explanation being the third in the Midrash, that he actually, right, is so angry because he doesn't get to inherit amongst Dan, and that's the fight. Okay. But then he's sentenced to death. And you realize that this feels really unfair. Like, we've just explained, like, he really is in a really unfair situation. Like, his father raped his mother. He was born the only mamzer, seemingly, that we know of in the Jewish people at this time of 603,000 or whatever, wherever we are exactly at this point, people, you know, he's the only person not inheriting. They're in the middle of a desert. It's not like he can go buy land in a city, right? Even if he can't inherit, like, he's going to be, like, he's out of the machane, like, he's out of the camp. Like, it's just a terrible situation, wandering through. You totally sympathize with him. And then God says, yeah, put him to death. And then the Torah has to answer a question, which is, how can you sentence this guy to death? Like, you just told me, you know, the Midrash tells you, this is unfair. The laws of the Torah are unfair. It's unfortunate. This guy is just trapped in a situation he can never get out of. So, really, how can you judge him? And what's the answer? There isn't a good answer, but the Torah's answer is, yes, you can. Because it may be unfair. It really is unfair. But no matter how unfair something is, that doesn't give you free pass. It doesn't give you carte blanche to do whatever you want. Because the nature of society is that everybody is sometimes in a situation that's unfair, and we don't just let you do whatever you want. And there are consequences to what you do. If we come back to our story, this is what Ray Forman points out brilliantly. This seems to be why that digression is not a digression. Because the digression, we focused on the list of the laws that are being listed, that are being said there, which is don't kill, don't damage, but it's not actually the emphasis of it. If you look at the emphasis of those psukim, starting again in Pasuk Yud Zayin, it goes like this. If someone kills, he gets killed. If you kill an animal, you pay for it. If you damage, you get damaged. The key doesn't seem to be any of those psukim, but Pasuk Chav Bet seems to be the key of the whole story, which is Mishpat echad yeh lochem, kager ka'ezrach yeh, ki ani Adonai lechem. There's one law for everybody, whether you're an ezrach or you're a ger, meaning whether you are a normal citizen or you're not, there is law because I am God. Meaning, those psukim aren't put there, they're put there to contextualize this law. Right? Imagine the story hadn't ended this way, that he blasphemed God. Imagine the story had ended that he'd murdered the person that he got into a fight with. Right? Most people would say, it's unfortunate, we understand why he's angry, but that doesn't give you free pass. You can't murder someone. If you murder someone, you're going to get punished, no matter how unfair your life has been. What if he'd, you know, burned down the guy's house or killed his animals? We would have said, well, I understand why you're angry, but you can't do that. Law is law. You have to be able to control yourself no matter how difficult the situation you're in. There's consequences. And that seems to be the function of these psukim, is this guy was in a fight. He was punching the other guy. I mean, that's true, right? They're fighting. You don't give him a free pass on fighting. You wouldn't give him a free pass if he killed the guy he was fighting. You don't give him a free pass. Why? Because you understand, law is law. Kager kezrach yeh lochem. He may not be, he may have lost certain land rights, but the law is still the law. He's still subject to the laws of society, and that's not an excuse. And it seems to be that this digression is just a way of contextualizing the Torah's message, which is, yes, it's unfair. Yes, he was in a really difficult situation. But you know what? Doesn't matter. You can't just do anything. You don't get a free pass. And just like if he killed somebody in this fight, he would have been held liable. And just like if he punched someone, if he curses God, he doesn't get a, you know, there's law. There are rules. You've got, no matter how hard your situation is, people always have difficult situations. There are consequences. We understand psychologically where he came from, but that doesn't justify. And that seems to be the digression here, is to teach us that point. Rav Tursky, though, adds something here, which I think fills out the picture, which is the Midrash seems to hint at a little bit more than that. The Midrash says, how did Moshe kill this guy's father, right? The rapist.
He looked.
So he looked, and then what does the Midrash say? The Midrash says something which it doesn't seem to have a source for. He cursed him by using the name of God. Right? Tversky said, where did the Midrash get this from? Midrash got it by seeing this story as the reflection of that story. Right? It connects it in both directions. It's not just that the Midrash learned from the literary similarities between the story in Shemot and this story that this was the child of that person. It also said, well, wait a second, how did he kill him? Well, by using the name of God. Just like this guy blasphemed, but he used the name of God for a curse. So he's saying that's what Moshe did also, right? They read this story sort of back into that story, but what does that do literarily? What the Midrash seems to be emphasizing is that he is the inverse of Moshe, because Moshe is a person also who faces extreme injustice, a really difficult situation that the Jews are in, right? And that this person is in, right? His reaction, though, isn't to curse God. His reaction is, right, to sympathize with the situation that's going on and try to work it out productively, try to right the wrongs, try to deal with it. And the Midrash seems to be hinting at, it's not just that there isn't an excuse. It's one thing to say there isn't an excuse, but there's more to that, is that Moshe also faced a difficult situation, and he tried to make the better of it. This guy may not get inheritance of land, but by giving up, by cursing God, right, by using God's name not to solve the situation, but to give up on the situation as a means of attack against somebody else, right? He chose to make the situation even worse than it needed to be. It's bad. It's admittedly bad. But Moshe, when he saw a bad situation, he managed to find a way out. And he notes the Vayetzeh in the Midrash story, right? In the Shemot story, Moshe is Vayetzeh and uses Shem Hashem, right? His Vayetzeh, his going out towards Echav, is as an outsider, is the beginning of him becoming part of them, right? He's grown up away from them as a Mitzri, but he goes out and he starts to identify with them, even as an outsider, to start to sympathize, to start to empathize, and he ends up being able to solve the situation. What the Midrash is emphasizing, there's actually another story here. He could have chosen to not, like he'd say, away from his brothers. He could have gone out to his brothers, as difficult as it was. He could have found common ground. He could have tried to make the best of the situation, and he didn't. And that's why, at the end of the day, even if we sympathize with his situation, we know that there are other outsiders who've managed to join the people, to become part of the people as much as they can. And Moshe, in the case, you know, becomes a leader. He seems to be the inverse, someone who chooses to leave his brothers because of the difficulty and give up on God and give up on the people. And that's why, in the end, Mishpat Echad Yelachem, we have to say that we uphold the law, as unfair as it is. And that seems to be the story of the Mikhalel, right? If you trace it, it seems to be this very carefully constructed story of describing this very unfortunate person, acknowledging the difficult situation that he's in, and yet at the same time teaching us that there is never, in the end of the day, an excuse to just say life is hard and therefore we give up on everything. There is another path that you can forge. And then just the last thing that Rutorsky knows, I won't read the sources inside, but to finish this, is the story isn't trying to hide the difficulty that this person is facing. Like, it faces it head on. Right? The Midrash, for sure, seems to emphasize how difficult this situation is. So Rutorsky asks, okay, well, is there any other solution besides for just this guy, you know, having, you know, somehow coming up with the courage and the fortitude to get through it and to commit himself to God and to the Jewish people, even though he is in certain ways an outsider? So he said, well, maybe part of the answer is are these key words, the Ger Nezrach, coming on the heels of the Yom Tov Parshiot. Because the Yom Tov Parshiot, right, which came right before this story, which is, right, the other half, right, the few, you know, Parshiot before in Emor, which is admittedly when this person is going to be feeling like an outsider. The Psukim emphasized that Kol Ezrach B'Yisrael Yeshvu B'Sukkot. And Rashi notes, I put it here in 11, Ha'ezrach ze'ezrach b'Yisrael ha'rabodet ha'gevrim, right, that, right, he already starts reading into Vayikra, that part of the story of Yom Tov is that the average Jew has to bring in the people who are unaffiliated, right, who are less affiliated, who feel like outsiders, and in Dvarim, that's explicit, right, in number 13, right, is this, right, in 12 and 13, on Sukkot, right, on Sukkot, right? When you're harvesting, the psukim tell you that lager ani lager tazov otam, that you give money while you're harvesting to those who don't have land, right? To the ger and to the ani. In Devarim, the Torah tells you that when you're rejoicing, you have to bring in the ger. Meaning, it's not just a message to the guy, right? That even when life is unfair, you need to somehow get through it and make the best of it. It's also a message to the rest of the Jewish people. Like, he is in a difficult situation, and that's why on Yom Tov, when we're celebrating, and those people have land and are part of the community, are celebrating and are reaping the harvest, those people who don't, you have to remember them. Meaning, he may not get inheritance, but if the Jewish people don't do everything they can to make the ger feel included, it is partially our fault that he's feeling as excluded as he is. So Tversky notes, on the one hand, this comes up in the context of the Moadim and the Shulchan and the Menorah to emphasize that, yes, part of what this guy is doing is rejecting the Jewish people even more than he really needed to, as difficult as the situation is. But on the other hand, the reason it's brought up in the context of Yom Tov is to emphasize the fact that because there are people like this who really are in a situation that's unfair, that's why around Yom Tov we have to go out of our way to bring those people in, to make them feel like just because we don't give them land necessarily doesn't mean they're excluded from the community. Right? It goes both ways. He needs to feel like a community, and we need to actually bring him into the community. And therefore, the story of the Mikalel thrown in the middle of these stories seems to bring together a lot of the themes that we've seen, the uniqueness of Klal Yisrael, the fact that this guy has the ability. Part of it, the community does have to accept him, but even when he feels excluded, the solution has to be Moshe-esque, right? To become part of the community and make the best of the situation, right? To vayetzeh and use God's name to help the Jewish people rather than vayetzeh and to curse God and give up on God because you don't feel like you're enough a part of the community. So it doesn't leave, you know, it leaves neither the Jewish people nor this guy off the hook, right? This guy does have to pay for his crime, because he doesn't get a free pass just because his life has been hard. But on the other hand, it emphasizes the responsibility, especially around the time of Yom Tovim, when we are celebrating, when we are feeling so part of the community, that we have to the people who might be feeling less part of the community, because we really do have to sympathize with their situation. So that's the story of the Mikalel.